in the course of our discussion, another word came up, one which I'm uncomfortable with, which one which is used in a completely decomplexed way in Indian, not learned discourse perhaps, but in popular discourse, is to refer to certain groups as tribals. Just to say, the tribals. And it's not, in my limited experience, but nevertheless, in discussing with people who have written on the subject, it's used in a very axiologically neutral way. It's value neutral, or it is supposed to be. But I don't know whether it's coming from... No. I am aware of that. It's not intended as a discriminatory slur by any means.
What I mean to say is that the default, the neutral understanding of it. I mean, of course, it's not a neutral term, but the fact that it's read as neutral is because people presume that whatever is in the Constitution is like an objective statement, which it's not. But because it is in the legal document, it's presumed as that.
It's also the whole idea of tribal. I think I told you about this. Is also the inability of the naming project of British, you know, or whatever, or even which also transform into Indian things. So when and they send these anthropologists or travelers to this kind of zones. So you when you are encountering, so for example, the famous Naga problem. Who is Naga? The Naga is about 17 tribes. So when the inability to name them, that okay, this area is inhabited by Rangmas or this kind of things, so they call it tribals. So these tribals, or so more, it is very interesting because at one point of time we collected a lot of this, this anthropologists, travelogues, and this notes and all kinds of things. And it's a very interesting exercise. What we found out, it's basically it shows their inability. It was not like National Geographic, but it is something which is has a very different kind of agenda. You know, it is not to understand those entities or their things. And it ends up that the name of this even books are very interesting. The Art and Craft of Northeast Frontier Agency, or the Tribals of Manipur. And those books remain still now. If somebody wants to engage academically to, say, do some research in, Manipur, they have to go through these documents, which will use these terminologies more than, 100 times in that book.
I'm not sure why you're so amused by this decomplexified notion of the tribal, because it's not restricted to just tribes. I think it's a question everywhere in terms of we are still trying to struggle with who is an Indian. And different political parties keep on invoking at different times. Like, are we Veer Savarkar's Indians, for example? People whose Matrubhumi, Punya Bhumi, and Karma Bhumi is India. In which case, what happens to people who are not a part of that imagination and so on? So all naming necessarily comes with that those kind of complexities. But then we cannot constantly just keep in an orbit of confusion where we refuse to name something or we refuse to... Because otherwise, then how will you ever say anything is the question, right? Mm-hmm. So there will be certain neutral categories which will have to be deployed, even though, because I'm not very sure if people are not aware of saying the ramifications or the complexities of saying the word tribal, for instance. For somebody who studied in Maharashtra for some time, the word Ghati, which for them does only means people of the valleys, but then, it has certain connotations in terms of being uncouth, being urchins, being not really very cosmopolitan and so on. But you deploy those categories, even if somewhat reflexively, to deal with some sort of a problem. So while the politics of naming is indeed important, it's also necessary to realize that naming is also a process of mediation. So that even if it's a false naming, the ability for you to articulate that particular form and say, I'm naming it this, is a process of mediation of different knowledges and different complexities as well. So I'm not sure why the tribe in particular is interesting to you, because for me the word Indian has also been equally problematized. I mean, V.M. Mrigang constantly telling us that we are not in India right now, that we are actually a bridge away from India, that we are in some bizarre frontier called the Northeast. But when I am in mainland India, now that we are making mainland and peripheries kind of an argument, Assam in my imagination is still India. For whatever ways, like when I say the Northeast, or when you're talking about, I can imagine the, for lack of a better word, resentment that comes from constantly reiterating a certain kind of geographical region as either glorified or exoticized or underprivileged, or you know the way in which a larger dominant center would deal with it. But I think that naming is also important. In terms that I think I quite appreciate the fact that you were saying that you do not want to destroy that naming process. Because in the naming process is a certain kind of political negotiation which is now possible. Imagine, because it's about this, if the structure refuses to acknowledge your transgression, it ceases to be a transgression, right? So if tomorrow the center actually grants and saying we will stop using the word Northeast, it actually takes away a whole lot of space of political negotiation for you, which that particular naming process offers as well. So for tribals, and I have some experience in dealing with some of the denotified tribes in Gujarat, where Ganesh Devi runs his foundation and so on, and there has been a certain strain of anthropology which has talked about how the tribal becomes a problematic category, it's a derogatory category, and we should not use it. But then there are people within the tribes themselves who talk about how much power it gives them to be a certain tribe, to be tribal in a certain form of a way, to be imagined in a certain form of a way, and what are then the new spaces which are not always visibly available to you in many forms, which are made possible because of that naming. One work that particularly comes in mind is Julia Elecha's work on Egypt, where she talks about how certain kinds of trading communities refuse to be renamed by the modern nation state in some form or the other, because in that naming process they lose the complexity and the implicit problems of being named wrongly, so to speak. So I thought I'd just kind of float that idea as a nuance, saying that I wouldn't be so surprised that people are using certain kinds of categories within implicit neutrality, maybe, in some ways or the other.
But Nishant, I think I didn't really, the whole idea of, not using or not standing for this binary, center binary, because we're trying to main. I think I said something wrong, but the idea is not to work on those binaries. The idea is to negotiate, because when you through periphery or through things, this is, we know we are inside India. We are, it's like, I will not say we are Indians or things, but we are in India. Because Indians is also very ambiguous. But secondly, what you're saying, sometimes it's not so, innocent, this naming project. It's not so innocent. Because certain piece of, and unfortunately, all these things, you have to give an example, like yesterday somebody was saying. So I'll give an example, because in the name of why, I said it something very plain and innocent, okay, everything is not his, everything is so, why not his, and think kind of things, and kind of, this representational issue we go through. But have you realized that we have, like, if you're talking about the political economy, Northeast has a parallel economy from the government of India. So there's a stakeholders which is sitting there. So we have a separate funds about, to tell you to very thing, it's about 33,000 crores per year, which comes to this central pool to develop this region. Now, I will not go into the various development and all kinds of discourses. But secondly, somebody was telling that is, which is coming from the government on the name of Northeast. Okay, Northeast is what so and so, blah, blah, blah. All the information I probably have shared with you, like, a tourist guide. Then comes the whole idea of what rest of the world is giving to this naming project. And you will not believe, this piece of information somebody told me, that if you put together all the underdeveloped countries in Asia together, what they get from UNESCO, UN, all kinds of things, it's much, much less what Northeast receives.
No, I mean, I... I don't think I was guilty of presuming innocence.
No.
Of any sorts.
No, no.
I was just saying that, in fact, I understand your point, and I think it's interesting that you're refusing to work with the binary.
Yeah.
Because when you're working with the binary, it eventually is a call to saying, name us correctly.
Definitely. Like, yeah, we're not so getting
on.
Into that.
But it's nice to retain this wrong nomenclature because it gives you certain kind of leverage and power. For example, I cannot imagine a project like Periphery happening anywhere in that part of India, from my understanding of it. So I was just saying that it's an interesting move to move out of those binaries and retain that nomenclature
true.
And then work at it in different ways.
It's what?
It's what Gayatri Spivak calls strategic essentialism. It's what Nishant is saying, that you don't mind taking up what is considered a wrong nomenclature so that you can use it in an empowering manner to negotiate politically for yourself. But of course, she also warns us that strategic essentialism, it's an identity that you take to bargain in the real world. It should not become addictive so that, you forget who you are and what you wish to become. And then where the naming itself becomes, more important than the political issues that you're fighting for in that name. And it's something that she says which you work on provisionally. Strategic essentialism is not something where you say, okay, this is the identity I take on forever. No, it is something that's constantly shifting. And it's something that which is a process which you're politically aware and conscious of. It's not at all innocent. But it's a tool for bargaining.
Like Nancy, to illustrate the situation, it's like, when you operate from here, and then there are certain situations or point of time that people want to include your work or as artist or as collective or things, sometimes it happens, this collective from Northeast. So what really happens? Like Lalit Kala, and we have refused this at least thrice. You know what they have done? They're doing this exhibition in, I think, south of India. So idea of, again, kind of creating some kind of diminishing borders. Contemporary art of Northeast. So I don't know what all these projects are going to take us and this kind of categories. And what are the things which is getting created?
Just to respond to what Sonal said about retaining her name, there is the Dilli Gharana of classical music, which doesn't exist in Delhi at all. It's all in Pakistan, for example. And they were here at a conference, and they very strongly want to retain that name, Dilli Gharana, although they don't exist. So that's another way of like retaining the original name too, so that you can trace the true genealogy of the project.
Where's Nishant?
He's on the phone.
Oh, he's here.
Do you want to hold? In fact, I think I wouldn't have raised this issue of the tribals probably if I wasn't from Canada, where Indians, as they were formerly called, and as much they're still known under the legislation which applies to them, the Indian Act, particularly iniquitous piece of law, legal work, they demanded to be known as First Nations. First Nations. And in fact, they were successful in their demand, and it's very rare now to hear a Canadian refer to them as Indians, even though in the United States, even people like Jimmy Durham, who was the former leader of the American Indian Movement, still talks about Indians. In Canada, they have become First Nations. That is probably because of a long-standing political battle between the so-called two nations that make up the French and English, and very successfully and very astutely, I think, the former Indians said, we're the First Nations, plural, and we'll be called that way, and in fact, we're acknowledged that way in the new constitution. And so then they can have their own self-nomination process, but collectively, there is a recognition in that choice that whoever may be here now and may call themselves a nation will be then negotiating with the First Nations. That was the first reason I brought it up. The second is because of King and Howard's choice of, and I'm really of two minds about it. It's not a critique that I want to make, because I understand what you're, not what you're driving at, but what you're digging at, is talking about indigenous knowledge. But indigenous also is a kind of a a double-edged sword, because I doubt that from the perspective of indigenousness that this is that type of self-understanding. It seems that when we talk about indigenous knowledge, we're talking about an outside position. And an attempt to valorize, certainly, but nevertheless, it seems to be that there's some remainder of that anthropological gaze.
Okay, so what would be a better term for that? No, because we're actually aware of these the very nature of this word, but we cannot find a better word. For example, we have tried, for example, vernacular. So I don't know. Okay, but back to the naming thing. One piece of news I read today, very interesting, is that has a new organization in India formed called All India Mothers in Law Protection Association. Okay, Mothers in Law Protection Association, which is the a group of mothers in law, grouped together, joined together to protest against the kind of portrayal in, for example, soap opera about the. So it's, I think it's a very interesting thing, and this is the name they give themselves. So a new community is formed. Formerly, we don't have this kind of a mothers-in-law community. So what I'm thinking is naming is actually, to me, is a part of a representation process. This not only being represented, but how you represent yourselves. For example, another example from our research is that, for example, the Wedding Car Street, where you see a long strip of a street. Previously, there's no one talking about the street using the term community. This is just a cluster of shops. But at the moment when they hang up this protest banner, saying, voicing out their pleas to the government to let them stay at this display, a community is formed. So to me, this naming process is not just a kind of a text thing, but also visual, can be visual as well. And yesterday, we talked about, we have this line, tag line, or punchline, saying that a community cannot exist without representation or being represented. So I don't know whether this is adding something to this another elaboration to this discussion.
I just wanted to respond also to Nishant and the conversation that's been happening. I'm in agreement. I mean, in sort of senses, yes. Strategic essentialism has its strategic uses, but. The point is that there is also, I think, we might bear in mind that, I mean, contrary to what you're saying, that is it impossible to think of creating a discourse that actually does not privilege the act of naming? I'd argue that it's well worth a try. I'm not saying whether it's possible or not. I'm saying it's as impossible as constructing a discourse that uses naming. In the sense that both are bound to fail, given the nature of what realities are. In this part of the world, we actually have the advantage of a fairly sophisticated philosophical canon that refuses to name things. And it's bound, it's actually based on a categorical refusal to name the self, which is quite different from, let's say, the by now dominant monist Hindu philosophical tradition, which says that there is one name for everything. What I'm talking about is the Madhyamika tradition in Mahayana Buddhism, which consciously says this effort to create a name, whether it's many or one, is bound to fail, because every time we try and correspond the name to the reality it represents, we find that either the name is bigger than the reality or smaller than the reality. So it says that, all right, if we have to work with names, then let us accept that names are conventions. The name that we give to the idea self is a convention. And if we say that it's a convention, which is an arbitrary and completely provisional construction entered into by a few contracting parties, that is the self that I call me and other people who identify me as the self, then that is satisfactory and will do as a pragmatic measure. But it still does not describe the reality that we are trying to portray. It says that it might be more interesting to talk in terms of what the relationships are between, that is, to describe what the network is rather than to identify the nodes, assuming that the nodes have a permanence. So it's trying to say that the network has probably greater descriptive potential than the nodes themselves. And I think that's an interesting way of thinking about the naming of practice and an articulation of identity. The identities that pass through me on a daily basis are themselves in some kind of relational field. So who I am on a day-to-day basis is an agglomeration or the net effect of the pluses and minuses of all the identities that course through me. So attempting to describe who I am, which is, for instance, in the case of Sonal, someone with a Banya history in the Northeastern present, is an attempt to describe that relationship. I mean, she may have chosen to take another name if she was not in the Northeast, right? So being in the Northeast, choosing that name, is an indication of a relationship between her history and her present. And what that describes is the relationship. So when we look at a name, and if we are willing to say that the name is actually just a placeholder for a complex web of relationships, then it's an interesting proposition. But then it's almost impossible, if you do that, to construct a kind of politics based on that act. I mean, you can at the most construct a politics of a very carefully constructed reticence, your figure of the lurker, that I will let my identities lurk within me while I act. I mean, that's something that I'm quite comfortable with. But it's not to say that my actions are the proof of my identities.
That's in some way what I was hinting at when I was saying that naming as mediation rather than naming as a fixity of certain sort. And I found the Peripheries project interesting for that reason. Was it that we are working with certain kinds of constructs which are given to us, but instead of trying to now reformulate them or clamor against them or talk about the injustice of it, it's easier to now go ahead and mediate between certain kinds of spaces which would not have been possible if you were caught only in the politics of renaming, rephrasing, or making meaning out of it or something. So, yeah.
That I completely accept, that it is quite, I mean, for instance, the to go back to the tribal naming question, the term in Hindi that is often used for tribal, which is also now by now got a constitutional validity, is as well as Adivasi or Janjati. And Adivasi means first peoples, the original peoples of this land.
Which also Oranasi means.
Yeah,
the
exactly. Yeah.
You would agree that there's a big difference between first peoples and first nations. That's a very strategic difference.
Well, it doesn't even mean first people. It means first inhabitants in this case.
The original inhabitants. Like from the Adi means the beginning
it's
of time.
Aboriginal, really. It
the
means
beginning
aboriginal.
Of time. So, you know.
Yeah, of course, in different.
Can I come back to that? I mean, going through the tribal question and strategic essentialism. I mean, the problem with the word tribe is that it has had a very problematic history. I mean, you know, I mean, there are the ways in which it all began, and there are moments in history where, when it has been applied, say for the Central Asian tribes, for example. It's not a very simple equation that it's some Western episteme which is imposing it on them, because their own history, say the Kazakh Confederacy, you know, I mean, very clearly they have defined themselves historically as a confederacy of groups who have come together and politically kind of been imperial forces and things like that. But then when it's applied to the so-called Northeast, then obviously that breaks down because maybe those dynamics are not at work. So I mean, this history of the word tribe has very problematic, because sometimes it has some kind of historical validity, and just critiquing the word as a Western epistemological category doesn't work all the time. And so much so with the word caste, which is increasingly one realizes that it's not just a Western imagination, but there were castes before. So Portuguese or Western, but along with the strategic essentialism thing, the problem I have with it is, and coming back to Shuddha's point, that if you do conversion studies in certain parts of India, or conversion studies all over the world, now coming to certain consensuses that a conversion is rife when there is social mobility, political trouble, and so on and so forth. That conversion is always a double-edged sword, that people do not convert immediately to a different identity. So there is a naming process, a secondary naming process. You have an original name, and then your guru or the converter gives you a new name, which is a secret name to begin with. To the extent that people who do not move on to the larger historical framework through strategic essentialisms and so on and so forth, by saying, say, okay, a group in Gujarat is converting to a certain form of Islam, but they can't immediately say that we are becoming Islamic because it's problematic within the hegemonic realm. It's problematic to directly come out and say that. So if you look at the history of the peoples in Gujarat, then you will find that, you know, certain people have moved on to a more cosmopolitan, hegemonic identity within. But there are certain people who still retain this double identity. And then it becomes a very strange process of thinking what then this naming process is all about, because it exactly bears out what Shuddha says. And then naming, again, as I was trying to point out yesterday, was that it then becomes a spectrum, you know, within the same name of Shia Islamis who have the maximum amount of double identity people. And this is also rife in Yugoslavia, where there are these, or the Druze, for example, who are very... They are exactly. I mean, this double naming, and the point that then comes up is what Lesercle is also talking about. He's bringing back Althusser in a very interesting way. He's saying interpolation, that at the end of the day, the naming is connected with interpolation. And politics will lie in not being interpolated, because as long as you're interpolated, you will keep on naming, and naming will then become, the more chaotic the situation is, you will have that many names given to yourself, because you will be then doing strategic essentialisms of all kinds, and will become what Shuddha says, a number of complex relationships coming into one name. And what Lesercle is trying to say is that politics can only be by questioning interpolation, again in a very radical way. Do I want to be interpolated in the first place by anything? And whether the naming process is a problem from the point of view of being interpolated. That naming can only happen when you are interpolated. And the tensions of that interpolation naming process is precisely what produces the bad words. Because when you can't decide, that is when you start becoming abusive. And then you start, you know, throwing out a certain psychotic reaction to this plurality which is hitting on you. And I found that very interesting. I mean, I found that logic very interesting, where naming and interpolation were kind of connected.
Are you implying that the idea of plurality is problematic?
Yes.
But that, I think that's profoundly contrary. Well, but there's a different, I mean, like, for example, the word nigger, right? Now, in a short span of 50 years from an insult, it is a mark of community within the community, right? You cannot... As an outsider, you cannot use the word, but within the community, it is a kind of almost a hallmark of that which proves your authenticity. That's a different kind of interpolation, but I think what Shuddha was talking about, it is precisely a kind of understanding of plurality as an ontological condition, as opposed to trying and sanitizing it into...
No, but that comes with culture. What does that mean? That plurality is not a cultural identity at all. Plurality is an entirely different organic process. It has got nothing to do with cultural identities, words, or language.
Mm.
That language is precisely a problematic...
Entering into a plurality of the self, which has nothing to do with the cultural world. That's why even when Vygotsky was working on Inner Speech, it's precisely this point that what is the relationship between the organic processes, turbulences of the body, and language? That what Zizek talks about is that it's a sudden reflex. The voice is a reflex. It's after all organicity which produces a surplus, which produces the voice. That it is an emergency condition. The voice is an emergency of the body, which is an organic emergency. And Vygotsky was trying to figure that out by studying animals. When do they use voices? And so therefore the whole process of voice, speech, language is an emergency condition. It is always a moment of paranoia and panic because you're always choosing against a huge sensory field a word, a consonant or a syllable or a sound, which will always
Kaushik,
be...
Kaushik, I couldn't disagree more with you. I'll tell you why. Because I think articulation and understanding is not only occurring when we voice. I think even the act of listening, even the act of listening presumes, in my case, I will say categorically, an ensemble of listeners who listen in different languages to the same thing being said, right? Who listen in different languages. And I think listening in different languages has a very different valence from speaking in different languages. And if that listening in and it's not, listening in different languages is not necessarily identical with inner speech. No, but even...
Monica, I'd like to hear better what you're saying.
Coming in to say that the idea of very active naming, it's like there is no speech unless there is a listener. To speak in the void is not to speak at all. So the idea of naming, enunciation is important, but so is the fact that you can confirm its existence by being a listener. So in that sense, what Shraddha is saying is that it's not that you're making speech as the kind of moment of everything.
What Vygotsky or Lesser-Klesser are saying is a very interesting thing, that every word in a sentence is a name, so therefore there is no thing called naming. And the problem is when you have a grammatology, which Derrida is also talking about, when you have full stops at the end of sentences, and your syllabic emphasis, which breaks up a linguistic continuity which is connected to an organic flow. So punctuation is a problem. And therefore, the problem is that punctuation is what allows for naming and also to hide the fact that every word in a sentence is a name. Therefore, if you think that every word is either naming or it can be the opposite, that it's nothing, you know. So therefore, that contradiction has to be taken into account, that primary linguistic field within which naming is being produced has to be taken into account when we are talking about politics or anything. Because at the end of the day, all these processes are punctuations of experience. They're making us stop, think, position ourselves, whether we are speaking in a certain language, whether we produce a comma in at one point of a sentence or the other point of a sentence. So say, for example, commas are disappearing in sentences. Why? I'm sure there's a political reason. There's an organic process which is a presentation of a universal self being projected through changes of punctuation marks
But I think that this gives to the act of identity, naming and identification, an overtly linguistical and lexical bias. Whereas there are, I mean, just to take your metaphor of the biological and the organic further, I'll just share.
Well, that's fair enough, isn't it? There is a lexical and linguistic bias in naming.
No, because I think there are phatic ways of communication which are not translatable in strictly linguistic terms.
No, but my problem with what you say is that if every element of every sentence is an act of naming, then there is no more act of naming because it loses its externality. So it's a an uninteresting philosophical position.
No, of course, no. That because it becomes interesting precisely because there's a history of interpolation which then produces a punctuation marks within that non-naming and produces names and produces emphasis which says this is a name and this is not a name.
Kaushik.
Which is a historical project then, which becomes a history of languages and history of forms and poetics.
I feel an urgency to intervene here. Emergency. I'll give you a classic example. All my life, I have thought of myself primarily in even a self-reflexive, mocking way as Bengali until I came to Calcutta. And it was very interesting for me to understand that people, before they knew my name, which is so murderously Bengali, in many, and even my physiognomy, which I assumed was Bengali, right? I was told many times, you speak Bengali very well. And I said, of course I do, because I am Bengali. He said, no, you're not. And it took me a while to understand why they were saying this. And I said, I told them that. Then they said, oh, yes, you are a Bengali. You must be living in wherever else. And then I said, what is it? What is the suspicion that you have about my identity? What does it emerge from? And they said, it emerges from the way you walk. And what's very interesting, and I said, what is it about the walk? They said, we don't walk like this. I said, what do you mean? And they said, well, when you're walking, it looks like you're going somewhere. No one in Bengal does that.
You have given an nail on the head because you've hit the nail on the head. Now
it's true. It's true. In Calcutta, it's incredible. I see. Okay, sorry.
No, I mean it. I mean, to come back to the example, that's an absolutely ideal example because Bengali language has its beginning in a certain form of linguistic practice, which is entirely about walking. Chajapads are written in Sandhya Bhasha. Sandhya Bhasha means the language of the twilight. Now, it probably evolved because of the Buddhists going out to only, they could only beg in the evenings. So how do you recognize a fellow Buddhist and how do you recognize a fellow person was by your walk. And you would then code your sentences in a certain way so that you could, you know, so it's a completely magical rebus language, which, you know, you have various strange kinds of incantations, but only the insiders can understand that. You have, even in the 19th century, some Vietnamese villages revert to this form of linguistics because there's a crisis. The people who are our own should be recognized, and then it's a walk which then gives you, in the first place, to utter that word. Because even if you are inventing a secret language, if you meet someone, you have to have another mode of recognizing or giving you the confidence to speak that that secret language, and that was mode of walking. Now, so the point, what I'm trying to say is that whatever you say, the linguistic, I'm not trying to, you know, promote the linguistic, but I'm only talking about the linguistic because we are talking in language at the moment. Because at the end of the day, there are registers of translation, of intensity. What you're expressing is there in the organic. It's there coded within the movement of the juices of the body and things like that. You're not expressing anything more than that. It's certain political conditions, certain ways of life, certain ways of the way in which the sensory motor functions are ultimately circumscribed or used within a certain space, which is, of course, the whole genealogy of studies of behavioral sciences from which Vygotsky is coming, which will study animal tribe, you know, the child who doesn't speak, the mute child, the L'Enfant Sauvage, which is Truffaut's film. And therefore, then, at the very moment when Derrida is writing Grammatology, Truffaut is making the film, which is about a child from the forest, and the pedagogic process, there's an interface between that. Now, I'm talking about, so I'm not talking, the linguistic is merely a translation. It's a translation, and we need to figure out what is the pragmatic figure of the linguistic within the political, in the sense, when does the linguistic take on various forms of translating affect or what Negri was talking about.
Once again, you haven't avoided the same pitfall. You've simply displaced it to translation, because of course, if everything is about translation, then we lose the concept once again.
I
agree that translation is essential to this, but if you totalize it in this way, so that there's nothing that isn't translation.
But there isn't. I'm not totalizing it. That's where the historical comes in. That's ultimately what becomes interesting about this whole process is the historicity of this punctuation and translation and the pragmatic translation of various registers of expression through various registers towards the linguistic. I'm not at all saying that the linguistic is above everything. It's just one of the forms in which the translation happens.
Which brings us back to the question of being hesitant about privileging names, because
I'm doing the same thing. Exactly. Yeah. It's precisely for that I'm saying that the naming process, and I was referring to strategic essentialisms, and I'm saying that where that is a problematic project precisely because of that. Because at the end of the day, strategic essentialisms are a given. You know, this is chaos theory. I mean, you say strategic essentialism is a logic of chaos theory, that everything will be named, you know, provisionally and you will move on. So that is not the pivotal point of essentialisms or naming. I mean, the pivotal point is what I was trying to talk about is interpolation, which is what interpolates you into naming yourself in a particular manner, and how many names do you take on at a certain point in time. You can take on four or five names, within which one might be the strategic essentialist logic, or one might be strategic essentialism 1, strategic essentialism 2, strategic essentialism 3. So
Nal was saying that she has specifically refused, for example, this using of names as a form of strategic essentialism. Well, there would be a lot more things to say about Alyssa. I am afraid we're going to have to at least break for tea, because our friends Howard and King have a flight.